It's 1 o'clock, and the news now read by me, Jonathan Swain. The Israeli government has said it will release a limited number of Palestinian prisoners, some of whom have been in Israeli jails for decades. The announcement of the release, a long-standing Palestinian demand, came just hours after the US Secretary of State, John Kerry, said direct peace talks would resume between Israeli and Palestinian officials for the first time in 3 years. The last direct talks broke down in 2010 over the issue of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. A court in Italy has found 5 employees of a shipping company guilty of manslaughter in connection with the sinking of the Costa Concordia, the cruise ship which ran aground last year with a loss of more than 30 lives. The 5, who included the director of the company's crisis unit, had entered plea bargains. They received jail sentences of between 1 year and 8 months and just under 3 years. The captain of the Costa Concordia is being tried separately. The Prison Officers Association has insisted that its members used approved control and restraint procedures after a suspect in the murder of the soldier Lee Rigby was injured at Belmarsh Jail. 5 prison officers have been suspended following the incident in which Michael Adebolajo was reported to have lost 2 teeth. The Metropolitan Police is investigating an allegation of assault. The chairman of the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners has acknowledged that the powers of the elected officials need to be looked at again. Tony Lloyd was responding to a report by the Home Affairs Select Committee, which suggested it was too easy for commissioners in England and Wales to fire their chief constables. Hundreds of supporters have greeted the Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny on his return to Moscow, days after he was sentenced to 5 years in jail for embezzlement. Mr. Navalny, who was freed on bail while he appeals, confirmed he would continue with his bids to become the mayor of Moscow. And the weather, it will be staying fine and very warm, but with more cloud than during recent days, cooler and breezy in some central eastern areas. News and weather at just after 1:02. Now on Radio 3, the early music show with Lucy Skeeping.
Hi, welcome to the show and the soothing tones of the flautist Barthold Keuchen with preludes in E minor and C minor from L'Art de Préluder, published in 1719. The composer is Jacques Martin Otterter, whose 250th anniversary of his death we mark this week, and a man whose vocation in life must have been in little doubt. From his grandfather, a maker of fine oboes, flutes and crumhorns, to his cousins, brother and son, who between them taught and made flutes, musettes, oboes and bassoons and played them in the Royal Chapel and the Opera House, life with the Otterters must have involved an awful lot of blowing, boring, turning and tuning, although not necessarily in that order. Jacques Martin, though, was by far the most celebrated of them all. Born in Paris in 1674, he went on to have a brilliant career as a player and a teacher, and as we'll hear throughout the programme, as an accomplished composer, writing almost exclusively for wind instruments. He also published important treatises on the art of flute playing, packed with detailed instructions on things like technique, fingering, tonguing and ornamentation, they provide an absolute treasure trove of information for today's flute players about how things were done back in the 18th century. And one man who particularly understands their value is my guest today, the Baroque flautist and recorder player Peter Holzlach, professor at conservatories in London, Hamburg and Krakow. We talked about this most famous member of the Ottertaer clan, and I asked him about Jean Martin's nickname, Le Romain. Does that mean that he had strong connections with Italy? I mean, did he live and work there at some point?
Actually, he stands in a long tradition, not just of French instrument makers and composers and players, but also of people going abroad, something we've been ignoring for so long because we always thought the French had a closed shop. But musicians travelled. Even was an Ottertaer in London, you know, after the Restoration, and all these French wind players, especially wind players, came, including Bresson, the maker. There also seems to have been an Ottertaer for a few years working here. And Italy, we always thought about this fight, pro and against Italy, France. They loved Italian music. They only were not really allowed to live that passion at court, at Louis XIV's court, until after 1700, he sort of deteriorated musically. He had different financial problems and wars. So then the nobility grasps its chance, and Italian music, Corelli, basically, happens in the salons in Paris, still not at court. But yes, our Jacques Ottertaer traveled to Italy, worked there for 2 years. Somebody discovered in the archives of the Vatican a payment list of a certain Giacomo Ottertaer in the service of the Marchese Ruspoli as a maestro di flauto from October 1698 till August 1700. And exactly before that and exactly after that, he's back in Paris and he's on the payment rolls in Versailles again. So that fits. Now, Ruspoli was very close to the then Pope, Clemens the 11th. He was a benefactor of musicians. Later in the decade, 1708, I think, he sponsored Handel and other composers. Ottertaer, 10 to 1, must have met Corelli. He also quotes Corelli in his Lade Prelude, well over 10 quotes of his Opus 5, the then very famous violin sonatas. So we know now for sure that he was in Rome. So Le Romain was not just a nickname, he was proud of it. And he didn't hide it. He was still in the service of Louis XIV when he travelled. So he was allowed to travel there and he was allowed to use that name. But then there are lots of questions still to be answered. Why did he travel to Italy? When did he go? Who did he meet on the way? Did he travel from Rome to other places? Who financed this? Now, the Ottertaer was a rich family. His ancestors did very well. And he didn't do badly either. Was he employed just as a recorder player or also as a traverso player? So then that the last would mean that the traverso was introduced in Italy much earlier than we have been presuming up till now. And which music did he bring from Italy going back? Brossard, in his Encyclopedia 1695, claims that composers and organists in Paris are all very, very keen to compose in the new Italian style.
Sonata number 2 in D major by the celebrated Parisian composer Jacques-Martin Ottaterre, part of a set of trio sonatas he published in 1712. Frank Ternes and Marc Ontay were the two flautists, with Martin Bauer on viol da gamba and the harpsichordist Ewald de Meyere. So, like those at the very top echelons of Parisian society, Ottaterre was an admirer of the Italian style of music, and that piece displays its influence in the expressive, almost singable melody lines and the contrasting phrases and harmonic character. Mind you, the French were quite possessive about their own style of music, so how did this interest, perhaps even obsession, with the Italian style go down in general?
There were books published around 1700 pro and against Italian or French music. It was a very serious thing, but in practice, in the salons, the nobility was generally very keen on Italian music. And the Duc d'Orléans, who then becomes interim king when Louis XIV dies in 1715, he was a great music lover, flute player probably himself. Now, this is interesting because Ottaterre didn't earn a lot of money playing at Versailles. He got a lot of titles there, and it was wonderful, but not enough to support your family with. So he depended on teaching the nobility. The nobility had money. The nobility had the influence. Hence these instruments with ivory and very chic. And hence his instruction books written for the nobility. And in Principe de la Flûte, is his first flute treatise, in the preface he literally writes, well, if you really want to learn the flute, then reading this is not enough, and you should really take lessons with me. And he charged pretty sums for his tuition, very nicely so. And these treatises are really built up from nothing, from scrap, introducing music theory from a very basic level. I mean, he's a great pedagogical genius, at least in L'Art de Préluder. He really builds up a very clever system of how to improvise, which is in itself is nothing new. You know, 16th century Italy, the whole ricercare idea to improvise was standard. And with Caccini, that also came to France. And this is just a prolongation of something which always existed and still exists. Our problem, or most performing musicians' problem, is that we are stuck to printed music. We're the slaves of our music if we're not careful. And he only describes a common practice, but in a very didactical way. It's brilliantly done.
The Baroque flautist and recorder player Peter Holzlach. With still so much speculation about just how musicians should interpret Baroque music these days, how wonderful then that for flautists at least there is so much information. The pieces we heard at the top of the programme are of particular interest. They come from L'Art de Préluder, in which Ottaterre demonstrates the art of improvisation. He goes through the styles appropriate to different emotions, different tempi and time signatures, how to change key or modulate, and how to finish or cadence, giving examples in every possible key. As Peter explains, the preface is enlightening in itself.
L'art de préludé sur la flûte traversière, for the transverse flute, and then in small print also for the flûte à bec, the recorder, and the oboe, and all other instruments who can play a top line, basically. Now, that's a marketing trick, of course. The nobility played the traverso. The recorder had disappeared already, 1719, didn't play a serious role, but was still around. The oboe was the instrument for professionals. Oboes you don't learn privately, you know, for fun. It's hell to play in these reeds and all that. But it's a nice selling trick. Very interesting preface where he explains what a prelude is. You know, before you start playing your suite or your main piece, you improvise. And there are two types of preludes. One you prepared at home, you wrote down. And then there's the real prelude, prelude caprice, the improvised prelude. And that's what you should be aiming for. Wonderful. Then he explains all the tonalities, the scales, and straight away from the beginning he gives very simple examples of how to embellish very rough, basic musical material. If you like, I can play a little bit. This is a prelude in F minor for recorder. I could give you the basic form of the melody behind the ornamented prelude Otatera gives us, and that could be something like this. And now I deliberately give heavy accents on each bar line, which Otatera, he doesn't really write them, but he indicates it with a small, minuscule line. So you should think free of bar lines. But this melody now in an ornamented version. He delays the downbeat by an ornament, double ornament actually.
Peter Holzlach performing an example from Otterter's improvisation tutor, The Art of the Prelude, demonstrating the different ways a simple passage could be ornamented back in the early 18th century. We heard earlier how in certain circles of Parisian society, musical tastes were geared as much towards the Italian style as the French. But what exactly is it that makes the performance of a line of music quintessentially one style or the other? It seems the answer relates to the relationship between music and words, the natural emphasis of the French language itself.
That came from an early 17th century phenomenon created by Le Pléiade, this group of poets in Paris, at the start of the Baroque, where the Italians developed this seconda pratica with the continuo. The French created what they called vers à mesurer à l'antique. So verse measured like the antiques, the Greek would do it. And their idea was that accentuating words was not done by making it vertical like Italian, and staccato, molto, molto, importante, you start to. But the French would pull the consonants and the vocals. So ça c'est important. And then you get a very different feel for musical lines, and these ornaments Otterter writes about also in his Principe de la Flûte all serve this function of delaying. Very often, 90% of them delay the next accent. So if you have a text, mon plaisir sont charmants, something like that. Mon plaisir sont charmants. You would pull the text, so over the bar line, That's the basic function of these French ornaments. This way of accentuating, or rather organizing your performance of verse, of spoken language, resulted in pooling words on unimportant moments of the bar. What I just said, ah, mon plaisir son charmant, you know, the plaisir charmant, that's where the bar line is. You would never make a vertical accent, but ah, mon plaisir son charmant, tira, you get this very juicy inégalité, as they called it, that could go as far as pointé or piqué, yam padam padam, but then we're talking about a very extreme text. And this seems to be a very French speciality. And corresponding with that, of course, articulation, syllables you produce when you play a wind instrument. And that's also what Ottoter refers to in his Principe de la Flûte, although he never mentions the fact that it is based on text, because everybody knew this was common practice from at least the mid-17th century already. So you always have to envisage this music with a text, which is tricky if you're not a native French speaker. And that's also interesting to see in Ottoter's suites for flute and continuo. The interesting harmonies very, very often are on the what we would call the weak moments of the bar. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So you get a very interesting organization of your phrasing. That is very, very French this time. And that disappears when the Italian style takes over the 1730s, 1740s, and this is over. But for at least 100 years, say from Lully till somewhere in Ottoter's career, this was the standard way of supporting your text. And that's the wonderful thing about these brunettes, where you have songs with texts and then an ornamented flute part. You follow the text. You always serve the text.
Thank you.
gorgeous vocals of Marianne Quecksilver, demonstrating how the natural stresses of the French language could serve as a model for the sort of ornaments instrumentalists might use to embellish the melody. And doing just that with her was Bartold Koechen on flute, with Wieland Koechen on viol de gamba, and harpsichordist Gustav Leonhardt. Some lineup, I'd say. But Odoter didn't just discuss the theory of ornamentation in his treatises. In the second edition of his first book of suites, he published clearly written out examples. So what were these actual ornaments and what effect did they have on the music?
One example could be the porte-voix, porter la voix, to carry the voice, which the Italians also knew, portare la voce in the 17th century. With the French, they use it very often to delay the main note. So you get something like this instead of the raw version. That last syllable then would be delayed and with some extra ornaments, battement, they called it. Another example could be the accent, which also existed in Italian music, Caccini, accento. If you have a descending line, you could have the ornament could go up, sort of jump. And in French music, this then becomes an accent. To make it more gracious, to lift it up, and again to delay, to make the jump less harsh. Then there's something like finger vibrato, flattement, which again, I'm sorry to say, was nothing new. when you go to Italy, 16th century, you have all sorts of colorations of notes, and the comparison to painters, Giorgione, Tizian in Venice, is often made. Now, the French had this flattement, they called it. Unfortunately, they never give examples of where to use it, but it could make a note either softer or add some anxiety. So you do that with your fingers. And you can speed up or slow down. The specific character of a flattement, of this finger vibrato, is that it goes down, opposed to a normal breath vibrato. If you have a breath vibrato, the tone circles around the center. And with a finger vibrato, so you tickle the harmony, so to speak. So you see, these ornaments were not specifically French, even their names were copied from the Italian, but they were just done in a different context. And what Odoter writes about in this principe is basically describing a tradition which had been going on for generations already. A possible reason why he includes it, and also in his the second edition of his first book of suites, the French were so proud of their good taste, le bon goût. And this, of course, was an essential part of how to embellish it in the right way, with the right ornaments, the right taste. At a very basic level, he doesn't go into detail where to use it, how to use it. He just mentions a rough selection of ornaments. And then he adds, well, of course, there are many more you can add, and you've got to find your way. And if you want to learn, have lessons with me.
So let's hear something from Odoter's premier livre, or first book, which displays those written-out ornaments. A recorder takes the top line this time, played by Franz Brüggen. part of Jacques Martin Otterter's suite in B-flat from his premier livre de pièce of 1708. Franz Bruggen on the recorder, Wieland Kuchen, Viol de Gamba and Gustav Leonhardt on the harpsichord. Along with the familiar flutes, bassoons and oboes, the Otterter family workshops also produced an instrument known in France as the musette, and Jacques Martin composed several pieces for it. The musette, though, was basically a bagpipe, so wasn't it rather odd then to promote an instrument that was more associated with the peasant or country classes than with the wealthy urban-based amateurs who were Otterter's clients?
It's interesting. Why would you play the musette and why would you write a method for the musette? If you go to, for instance, the Wallace collection and you see paintings of the time, you see this very famous painting by Lancret of a beautiful lady dancing in her wonderful outfit, Madame Camargue, she was the leading dancer, in the middle of the forest. Why would she put on her best shoes in the middle of the forest? And there are Watteau and lots of paintings like that. There was this obsession of the nobility of ordinary people, the peasants. And you also find that in Otterter's music. You find often two minuets coupled together. One would be a chord minuet, very stylized, beautifully done. And the second one would be almost banal. That would be the peasants, how they would dance the minuet. And of course, you would have a da capo, so you would end with a courtly minuet. But you see that in paintings. And in this setting, the musette also fits, because it is a peasant instrument, but we play it very nicely with continuo on it. We made it out of ivory and gold brocade and... le bon goût, the right taste.
I love that sound. Music for posh French people who wanted to do a bit of a rustic thing, but in the safety of their own salons, of course. Shelley Groskin was the musette player there in Jacques Martin Otterter's Rigaudon from his book Méthode pour la musette. Well, I guess Otterter's great-grandfather, Aloysius Otterter, the woodturner, would have been proud of his descendant's success had he lived to see it, particularly when in 1717, around the age of 40, Jacques Martin was given the prestigious post of flautist of the King's Chamber. His great-grandfather would probably also have been chuffed to know that Otterter's lifelong promotion of the transverse flute through his performances, compositions and well-marketed tuition books helped to promote it as the must-have musical instrument amongst the fashionable classes of Paris, and that a good marriage had helped his great-grandson to climb still further up the social ladder. But perhaps it's Jacques Martin's tutor books for which he's best remembered today. He really was a good businessman. So let's end with music from his Deuxième Livre, his second book of pieces published in 1715. The keen-eared amongst you might pick out a pair of minuets, as Peter Holzlach described, a courtly, polite minuet coupled with a brash, rustic one, as might be danced to by the peasantry.
Thank you.
five movements from the Opus 5 Suite in G minor by Jacques-Martin Otterter, performed there by Wilbert Hazelsit, flute, Jaap ter Linden, viola da gamba, Konrad Junghedel, the oboe, and Jacques Aug, harpsichord. Today's early music show was presented by Lucy's Keeping, and the producer was Alwyn Fisher.
At the BBC Proms and live on BBC Radio 3, Viva Verdi. The second in a pair of concerts from Sir Antonio Pappano and the orchestra of the Rome Academy of Santa Cecilia includes the four sacred pieces and from the Requiem, the dramatic Liberame. Saturday night at the BBC Proms from 7:30.
Well, a very different prom in an hour's time this afternoon. The first prom's Saturday matinee of the season. Harpsichordist Richard Egar, soprano Sophie Bevan, and the Academy of Ancient Music with the programme celebrating the young Handel's visit to Rome. So, among other things, Handel Italian cantatas and Corelli's Grand Concerti Grossi. That's live here on Radio 3 at 3:00 this afternoon. 2:00 just gone, and now another chance to hear the first of this year's Proms chamber music concerts, which happened last Monday lunchtime. It was introduced by Petroc Trelawney.
Welcome to Cadogan Hall, the BBC Proms intimate second home. Over the next 8 weeks, we intend to explore chamber music in its broadest possible range. Our journey will include some of our finest singers performing Warlock, Britten and Dowland. We welcome to this wonderful hall an all-female brass ensemble. We'll hear Renaissance Polish music and a string quartet by one of our most alluring and neglected 20th century British composers. We start with the young Norwegian violinist Vilde Frang and her regular musical partner Michael Liffitz, who will perform the Partita by centenary composer Witold Lutosławski and a sonata from the last decade of Mozart's life. First, Ravel's Sonata in G, in which the composer announced he wanted to show off the essential incompatibility of the two instruments. "I am contrasting violin and piano," he proclaimed, "not making them cooperate." Well, it was his last chamber work. It took him 4 difficult years to write it. At one point, a student found him leaning over the grate where he'd just burnt the original version of the finale. The popular style of jazz music that had taken Paris by storm when he was writing this inspired the second movement, the elegant blues, which begins with an evocation of the sound of the banjo being strummed. Then the piece finishes with the movement that Ravel said illustrates my changing mood, a move away from what he described as the luxury of impressionism towards the rather darker side of 1920s Paris. To play Ravel's Concerto in G for violin and piano, please welcome to the stage Vilde Frang and Michael Liffitz.